From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Leanne Hansen, and this is Fresh Air. Dennis Smith spent 18 years as a New York City firefighter. That experience led to his best-selling book, Report from Engine Company 82. On this edition of Fresh Air, we'll meet Dennis Smith and discuss his new book, Firefighters, Their Lives in Their Own Words. We'll also meet actor Lou Diamond Phillips. Last summer, he played Richie Valens in La Bamba. Now he's starring in a new Western, Young Guns. Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new CD reissue of Kurt Weill's and Bertolt Brecht's masterpiece, The Three Penny Opera. And our urban legend expert, Jan Harald Brunvand, explains how we all got so scared of earwigs. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is Dennis Smith. For 18 years, he served as a firefighter in New York City. He wrote about his experiences in the South Bronx, and the result was the best-selling book, Report from Engine Company 82. Smith retired from firefighting to edit his own national magazine, Firehouse. He's chairman of the New York Academy of Art and is an honorary fire chief of the New York Fire Department. His new book is called Firefighters, Their Lives in Their Own Words. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks, Leanne.
There are so many stories in this book. Stories of urban firefighters, rural firefighters, volunteer, forest service, women, blacks. How did you choose the stories?
Well, I went from city to city, and of course I know, I've been going from city to city for now 15 years, and I know firefighters all over the country. Then I have an exceptional staff who works for with me at Firehouse Magazine, and they were helpful in identifying the right people. I chose them because of my confidence in other people. I would ask other people, look, I need to talk to somebody who's straight. I didn't want any local color heroes. I didn't want any, you know, those people who had popped their heads up for one reason or another. I wanted to represent the real average Joe, so to speak, firefighter, but yet people who have had very particular experiences. Mm. And so as I went from city to city, I met these people. I was very moved by two things. Number one was the great humility that comes forth, and because I had to exact from them. I mean, every single moment of drama, because they were not, it's not that they were normally reticent, it's just not anything they would talk about. And the other thing that struck me as very, very interesting was the reverence with which they talk, because there's so little eschatology in this book that, I mean, I thought that we could sell it to the Christian book club, you know what I mean? It's just a wonder, because you think of firefighters as being tough men and women, you know? But they do talk with a special kind of respect for what it is that they do. And no matter what I try to do, because I don't curse very much, I never did in my whole life, but I would even gratuitously throw a cuss word in once in a while to make them feel perhaps at home. But yet the language was very straightforward and very direct. And
didn't they find it easy to talk to you, though? I mean, you are a firefighter. You have had some of similar experiences.
Yes, I don't think that anyone else except a firefighter could have done what I have accomplished in this book. And I don't say that with a sense of egocentricity. I just think that any firefighter could have done it if the person to whom he was talking knew that he was a firefighter and respected the person for firefighting. I do think it's in kind of an in-group confidence that permitted people to talk so spontaneously.
It's interesting to translate what they've said into print and now to talk about it, because you mentioned that firefighters rarely explain or describe what has happened to them, even to the fellows in their own engine company. It's a look that they give to one another. So there's this immediate camaraderie. It's almost like veterans of a war.
It is. In many ways, I could just tell you, I had the very happy privilege yesterday of talking to Vice President Bush.
I noticed your cufflinks. They're a gift from him, yes?
Yes, he gave me these cufflinks. And I talked to him mostly about federal problems relating to firefighting in America. But one of the things that I was very conscious of is that firefighters are very much like, and that he would understand, firefighters are very much like combat troops. That is, that they need leadership, that if they are competently trained, you know, they are going to respect each other and they're going to rely on each other, and they need leadership and direction. And they don't want to be led on a garden rosy path ever.
Well, because of the situation that they're in.
Exactly.
It's life or death, isn't it?
It's life and death, but most of, but particularly, there are lots of life and death situations in life, I must say, but in firefighting, it really depends on seconds. So you don't have an awful lot of time to be analytical in firefighting. You have to account immediately on your recall and experience.
And you need someone who can marshal the troops, analyze the situation, and then do what needs to be done. It's split second.
Yes. Uh-huh.
I was surprised to learn that the training for firefighters is generally only about 12 weeks. I mean, that's summer camp, isn't it?
It is, but you must think of that in relation to the rest of the training they do every day. I mean, every day a firefighter's in the firehouse, there is a training period. And so you're continually going over the skills that you have. I mean, this, you know, to deal with hose and to deal with ventilation, the science of ventilation, where you put a hole in the roof, or what windows you break, and for what reason, depending where the fire is and the volume of fire, and depending where the other firefighters are with the hose, all of these things come into play. Search procedures, you know, rescue procedures, hose. Different kinds of connections that are used in water hydraulics, different kinds of pressures that are involved. The list is just endless of things that you have to know, but they're all fairly fundamental. You know, there's just a lot of them. Mm. And in that, some places it's 12 weeks, other places it's 14, 16 weeks, depending. Mm.
But you call it school is okay, but experience is really the teacher. That first fire. Many of the stories that you have in your book are about people's first fire.
Yeah, and it also depends on the people with whom you're working. I think that you have to rely an awful lot on the people you're with, so that those first fires, if you're with a really good firefighter who cares about you and guides you in, you know, inch by inch, and gives you motivation and enthusiasm all the way, then I think it's really helpful, and you carry that with you the rest of your life.
Can you tell us why they called you U-turn Smith? It was your story of your own first fire.
Oh, it was just that we were just going into a building in the South Bronx. There were several apartments, rooms on fire, and as we were going in, I knocked it, what we call knock down. You know, you extinguish the fire in one room. And but the fire was really very hot, and as we were going through, we were on our really knees and soles of our feet like that, going, trying to get through as quickly as we can to the next two or three rooms of fire. And suddenly the ceiling collapsed. So as the ceiling collapsed, it didn't collapse so that it hurt any of us. We collapsed in lots and little pieces, and these embers just went right down my back, into my open collar and down my back, and so it was, I was pretty severely burned then, but it hurt a lot, I gotta say. So I immediately spun around and started going the other way, and so they called it the U-turn approach to firefighting, you know.
So. You speak about getting hurt so dispassionately.
Well, it's a long time ago, number one, and number two, there's a story in this book about somebody says, I'm not quite sure where, about getting hurt is just part of the job, and that you can't expect to do this job without getting hurt, that ultimately sometime you got to get hurt. Now, if there's a safety officer in some fire department listening, he'll be furious with me now for saying this, because ideally if a firefighter is safety-minded, he shouldn't get hurt. Because most of the, in firefighting, you know, suffers more deaths in the line of duty than any other occupation. And a lot of those deaths could be cut down because a lot of them are predictable, and it takes knowledge and experience. I mean, before a wall falls, there are normally indicators that the wall is going to fall, or a ceiling, before a fire flashes over. some firefighters die because they haven't had adequate training on the use of masks. And, you know, I think you just put a mask on, you go into a burning environment, and that's, when the mask runs out. But sometimes it malfunctions, or sometimes the air expiring bell won't ring, or whatever. And you have to be trained in order to deal with that, because it's a long time to get back out into free air, and sometimes they don't make it.
Yeah. Where do they get the discipline to just keep from running away? I mean, this is so dangerous.
Well, I think that it takes a lot of experience. And I don't think that you ever quite transcend the fundamental fear of fire. It's not really a fire, quite frankly, Leanne. It's just the fear of dying. I think it doesn't really matter what you're doing. It's just the fact that the possibility of dying is in, there is an innate apprehension. And you get over that, never quite. But you do learn to deal with it as time goes on, with experience and learning how to operate in those environments. A few weeks ago, I was up at the funeral of these five firefighters who died in the Hackensack, in an auto showroom in Hackensack, New Jersey. And as a good example, I watched the complete videotape of that fire, which was about 45 minutes long before they had the fire under control. And the fact that these folks, men, went into this building, and the fire was pretty substantial, you know, and so you knew that the environment was dangerous. Now, the roof came in. Were there indications that the roof was going to come in under such fire conditions? I mean, I don't know. And I'm sure that some investigatory body will determine that. But, because I'm sure there'll be a lot of litigation when five people die in a fire like that. But the fact is that these firefighters knew that there was a danger in that building. But they were there nonetheless, because that's, you know, we fight fires from the interior. And the reason we do that is because we try to save the buildings. Now, there are 2.5 million fires in America every year. If we just fought all these fires from the outside, I mean, we now have $7 billion worth of property damage in America. If we changed our tactics, we would have maybe $100, $200 billion in damage a year. So we save the buildings, and that's the whole point of firefighting. I mean, it is a fight. It's not a containment. You fight it. You try to conquer it as beginning a stage as possible.
My guest is Dennis Smith. His book is Firefighters, Their Lives in Their Own Words. You talk about saving buildings. Another task that firefighters are often faced with is saving people. Going into a building that looks dangerous, that might collapse on them, that might burn them severely, to rescue someone.
Well, you know, there are all kinds of situations. I interviewed one firefighter in Philadelphia. Henderson was his name. A black firefighter. He was working with a white partner, and they were called to a collapse. They were assigned to the paramedic squad, the ambulance. They're Philadelphia firefighters. And they were sent to a building collapse in Philadelphia. And they pull up, and there's a woman outside the building, a black woman, yelling, "My baby is in there, my baby." So they, both of them, go running into the building, right? And the building's completely collapsed, and it's being held up like a deck of cards. I mean, at any given time, a splinter could break, and this building could just collapse more completely. So they go into this building, and they find a little child, about 2 years old. And it's still conscious and everything, and it's caught in the corner with the debris. And so they pick the child up, and they bring it out, and they give it to the woman. The woman says, "That's not my baby." So, it's funny when you think about it. That's not my baby. So, of course, they gave the baby to somebody, and then they go back into the... Now, in the meantime, there was a helicopter that came and started hovering above. And the chief got there and was in charge of the fire. And these two guys were the only persons that were permitted in this environment. And it's called, and they were doing a search to find this baby. And they knew that they were in there too long. And Henderson said to his partner, "I think that, you know, we're here much too long. We better get out of here." Because it was very, very tenuous. And the partner said, "You know, if there's a baby in this building and we leave it, I'll never be able to live with myself." And so they continued the search, and finally they stepped on a door that had fallen down. And as they stepped on the door, the baby screamed, because the baby was underneath the door. So they picked the door up, got the baby, and brought the baby out to the waiting woman in the street. And Henderson said, you know, it was a great moment for him, because number one, he always got along well with his partner, and he really believed that they cared for each other. But here they are. Henderson's a black man, and the partner's a white man. The baby was black. Henderson thought that they were in terrific critical danger, and the partner said, see, it transcended color or transcended anything except the fact that there was a human life at stake, and he wasn't going to leave it. So,
amazing story. My guest is Dennis Smith. He is the author of Firefighters, Their Lives in Their Own Words. I want to talk to you more about this profession of firefighting after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is former firefighter Dennis Smith, author of the best-selling report from Engine Company 82. His new book is called Firefighters, Their Lives in Their Own Words. You've related the story of a rescue of a baby who made it, but there are a lot of victims of fires that don't make it. And the firefighters have to deal with that because death is a fact of their life. Are there any psychologists or people that they can talk to help them deal with this?
There are, yeah, and the fire service is very stress conscious nowadays. And as a matter of fact, there are critical incident stress debriefing teams that exist in various parts of the country. University of Maryland is very active in this, where they, you know, the firefighters I talked to, who was at the terrible plane crash in Detroit where they found the little girl in the chair.
Yeah.
Well, I talked to that firefighter,
yeah.
I found her. And he was saying that the stress debriefing team came in and he talked to the person, but he wasn't interested at all in what the person was saying because the person had no fire understanding, no experience as a firefighter, no understanding of firefighting, no understanding of the culture and the traditions, the history. And so they weren't influenced at all by that person, but yet they understood that they needed some critical stress debriefing because that was terrible carnage that these men and women had to deal with in that plane crash. Another incident was in the Hackensack fire. They knew immediately that they had these folks dead in this building, and so the stress psychiatrist was asked to come in while the fire was still, it was out, but it wasn't completely over yet, you know. And he came in and he told the Hackensack firefighters with whom these five men were working that they should not go in, that they should stay out of that building and not go in again. But now you see that fella, while he understood psychology, did not understand the culture of the fire department, because when it's one of your own company that is caught in a collapse or and you have to go in and find the body and take the body out, that's your responsibility. I mean, it's, you know, and it would be worse if you didn't meet your responsibility in the culture of the firefighting tradition. So the answer is yes, we do. We are very cognizant of the need for stress help. But that help has got to still be developed so that the help is provided by people who really understand firefighting.
Do you think this is a symptom, essentially, of the way that firefighters are treated? by politicians, by the public. It's a civil service job, so it's got to be the victim of politics and budget cuts and, to a certain extent, a lack of understanding about what the daily job of a firefighter is.
Yeah, I think that firefighters don't get a great shake from the municipalities they work for. And volunteer firefighters, on the other hand, very often are thought indifferently by the are thought of indifferently by the public they serve. I don't think it's a great problem, I must say. I think that there are more significant problems that firefighters face than this kind of one of public relations. Problems of hazardous material, problems of equipment safety, those kinds of things are certainly much more important to the firefighters' interests.
But with cities cutting budgets, do they have access to the kind of equipment, say, the kind of equipment that you advertise, essentially, in your magazine, Firehouse? It's all state-of-the-art stuff.
It is indeed, yeah. No, and there are lots of fire... I mean, most fire departments today are still operating without personal alerting devices, which is the device, if you're in a building collapse and your body does not move for 10 seconds, this device emits a very loud signal. And it's waterproof and all those things that you would expect it to be. And in New York City, every firefighter wears one. In some cities, some departments, only the person who has a mask, it's attached to the mask. And so the city couldn't afford to give every firefighter one. But I think ultimately every firefighter ought to wear one of these things on his person when he's in a dangerous environment. Those kinds of things exist, and the the firefighter, I think, as a political constituency, in most cases, have not really banded together to use their influence as a part of a voting public. There are 1.5 million, 1,500,000 firefighters in America, and I suppose with their families, there are about 3 million votes. And the surveys show that firefighters vote with great predictability, about 90%, which is very high as a group. So there's considerable amount of voting power out there. The problems of firefighters are not so much personal problems, but they're problems that ultimately relate to the public safety. You know, I mean, as a firefighter is better trained, as the National Fire Academy is made more relevant to the firefighters' needs, ultimately, the firefighter is better trained, but the public is better protected. So this is not a kind of a selfish self-interest that this group has, but it's kind of for the larger good. There should be some movement there.
Was this sort of moving personally for you, a former firefighter in the South Bronx? You know, had to put on the rubber boots and the rubber coat and the helmet and all. Dressing up in a white shirt and a blue tie with fire helmets, red fire helmets all over it, and meeting the Vice President of the United States?
Yeah, it was a big deal. I had been in the Oval Office, actually, when Jimmy Carter was president, and had met with him. But now I want to meet with the candidates, and I can do that because I am the editor-in-chief of Firehouse Magazine, which reaches so many people, and so that gives me a certain kind of entree. And I was very honored by that. I mean, and I couldn't help thinking that, of course, I have an extraordinary sense of my own past. I quit high school when I was a kid. I never went to high school. And I did manage to go to college in later years, but I skipped completely the high school years. I just quit and went to work. And so here I was, a high school dropout, sitting in the office with the Vice President of the United States, and it was a great honor. And I couldn't help thinking during that period of time, when I was a little boy, about 6 years old, the thought occurred to me, as with my mother and my brother, huddled on the fire escape of the tenement where we lived on 56th Street in Manhattan, and there was a fire in our old tenement building somewhere. And I couldn't help thinking about that even if the house burned up, my mother had to be thinking at that moment. Her only job in life was to protect her two children, and she had nothing. I mean, if the apartment burned up, there was nothing of value to lose. you know. And as long as she had her children out in the fire escape, that's all I'm sure she cared about. Maybe some photographs or something that would have some sentimental value, but we never had anything. So it was a long, and particularly being like the firefighters would move past us and go up and down the fire escapes and various parts of this building because it was on fire. So this juxtaposition with the firefighters there on the fire escape and knowing that my mother was, you know, in risk of losing her everything that she owned, which wasn't anything anyway, and then sitting here with the vice president, I thought that that was a long road. It was a very American road. I don't think that that you can make the kinds of travels that I've made in my life in any other country. I think America is wonderful in this way, that it doesn't matter if you're the child of an immigrant, as I am, or you know, if you were born in a welfare apartment in the South, as to very poor people, as Jesse Jackson was, or it doesn't matter. But this country will provide if you want to work for what you want.
Do you miss firefighting?
Yeah, I do. I miss a lot. Not so much the firehouse work, you know, I mean, there's a lot of that I found very tedious, but
washing the windows, polishing.
Yeah, that kind of thing. even building inspections and things which are important, but I it's not to me very exciting. But I miss the talk in the firehouse. I miss the languaging that goes on. I miss the being out in the street and not knowing what's going to be there when you go. You know, that is a very exciting part. I was reading recently that there's a kind of a very primitive need that we have in I was reading this in an essay, a psychologist essay on roller coasters, believe it or not, that human beings have a primitive need for excitement. It comes from hundreds of thousands of years we spent as hunters in developing the human psyche. And so this primitive need for excitement is not fulfilled anymore. And I guess that's what I feel. I feel that need for the excitement of going to something that you don't know what's going to be there, and when you get there, you don't know what you're going to do.
That sounds like why I became a firefighter.
Yes.
Dennis Smith, thank you very much for being our guest today.
Thank you, Leanne.
My guest has been former firefighter Dennis Smith, author of the best-selling Report from Engine Company 82. His new book is called Firefighters, Their Lives in Their Own Words. I'm Leanne Hansen, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with film and video director Julian Temple. He began making rock videos in his native England during the 70s with the Sex Pistols, went on to direct the feature film Absolute Beginners. His new video, in which Neil Young takes on the corporate sponsorship of rock and roll, has been banned by MTV. We'll discuss it, and I hope you'll be able to listen.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from World of Travel Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner, designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Leanne Hansen with Fresh Air. I'm filling in for Terry Gross, who's on vacation. Last summer, actor Lou Diamond Phillips played rock star Ritchie Valens in the hit movie La Bamba. Coming up, Phillips talks about trading in his guitar for a horse and a few knives in the new movie Young Guns. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the compact disc reissue of the Three Penny Opera by Kurt Weill, featuring Weill's wife, actress Lotta Lenya. And Jan Harald Brunvand explores and explodes another urban legend, this one about the deadly earwig. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. President Reagan this morning vetoed a $300 billion defense authorization bill, saying the measure endangered his Star Wars program and progress in arms control talks with the Soviets. NPR's Cookie Roberts reports.
President Reagan said he had lost patience with the liberals in Congress intent on weakening the nation's military. The president cited language in the defense bill limiting some nuclear testing and requiring compliance with some aspects of the SALT II agreement. He also criticized the amount of funding for the Strategic Defense Initiative, or Star Wars program. But since the bill passed both houses of Congress with big bipartisan margins, and since the Secretary of Defense and National Security Advisor had worked with the lawmakers in crafting the legislation, Democrats contend the veto had more to do with election year politics than with national security policy. They say the president wants to paint the Democrats as soft on defense, but they insist that tactic won't work this year. But just in case the president is successful in convincing the voters this bill was not tough enough, the Democrats are avoiding a record vote on a veto override, choosing instead to attach the defense bill to another measure. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
Matthias Rust returned to Frankfurt, West Germany today. He had been serving a 4-year sentence for flying his small plane through Soviet airspace and landing it in Red Square. The daring stunt caused a big shakeup in the Soviet military. Rust's pardon by the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet reflects improved relations between the Soviet Union and West Germany. The TASS news agency said Rust apologized for his flight, and it called his release an act of humanism. The House today voted to impeach U.S. District Judge Alcee Hastings. Hastings, Florida's first black federal judge, now faces a trial in the Senate for high crimes and misdemeanors. Hastings was acquitted in 1983 of conspiring to solicit a $150,000 bribe. But the House Judiciary Committee filed 14 perjury charges against him, stemming from testimony in that trial. For Hastings to be removed from his post, 2/3 of the Senate must vote to convict him. In Florida today, Hastings said he believes he will be vindicated. President Reagan ignited a political controversy at the White House today by calling Democratic presidential nominee Michael Dukakis an invalid. The president quickly said he was just joking. Dukakis appeared unruffled by the remark. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Appearing in the White House briefing room this morning, the president was asked by a reporter who writes for a publication sponsored by political extremist Lyndon LaRouche whether he thought the Democratic nominee should release his medical records.
Do you think that American people deserve to know whether he's fit to govern by having his medical records made public?
Look, I'm not going to pick on an invalid.
About a half an hour later, at a separate appearance, the president backed away from his barb but did not apologize.
I was just trying to be funny and it didn't work.
Ever since the Democratic convention in Atlanta, the LaRouche organization has been spreading unsubstantiated rumors that Dukakis has undergone therapy for depression. In Boston today, Dukakis denied ever having such treatment or having consulted with a psychiatrist. And he said he would be happy to provide a full report on his mental and physical condition. Said Dukakis, "I'm a very healthy guy." I'm Brian Naylor at the White House.
The Senate today voted 85-11 for a sweeping trade bill that would require U.S. retaliation against trading partners found to have unfair barriers against American goods. The vote came after Democratic and Republican leaders fended off a series of proposed last-minute changes. The unsuccessful amendments ranged from proposals to limit fur imports from the Soviet Union to a bid to ban all imports from Afghanistan. The bill has received final congressional approval and has been sent to President Reagan. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed today at 2134.07. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. 60 years ago this month, one of the great musical and theatrical works of the century, Threepenny Opera by Kurt Weill and Bertolt Brecht, had its first production. There's a new CD reissue of this work, as well as two others featuring Weill's widow, Lotta Lenya. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review.
CBS has performed a valuable service in reissuing on CD its classic recordings of two Kurt Weill masterpieces, Threepenny Opera and The Rise and Fall of the City of Mahagoni, recordings that are both historically important and theatrically riveting. Both were originally supervised by Weill's widow, Lotta Lenya, and on them she also recreates her original Broadway roles. Lenya was an actress, not a trained singer, but her tremulous, gravelly, ironic voice is the perfect embodiment of the romanticism gone sour that is at the heart of this music.
Oh, show us the way to the next whiskey bar.
Oh, don't ask why. Oh, don't ask why.
For we must find the next whiskey bar. For if we don't find the next whiskey bar.
I tell you we must die. I tell you we must die.
I tell you, I tell you, I tell you we must die.
Lenya also made two LPs that CBS has converted to CD with more dismaying results. One was an album of Weill's Berlin theater songs, mostly collaborations with Bertolt Brecht. Songs like Mack the Knife, the Alabama Song, the Bilbao Song, and Surabaya Johnny. Songs that became pop hits for such singers as Bobby Darin, Louis Armstrong, The Doors, and Bette Midler. But who else could give them Lenya's unique edge?
Oh, moon of Alabama, we now must say goodbye. We've lost our old mama.
Lenya also recorded an album of theater songs Weill wrote after he emigrated to America in 1935. His Broadway shows, Lady in the Dark, One Touch of Venus, Knickerbocker Holiday, which September Song comes from, have remarkable numbers in them. Weill worked with distinguished lyricists, Ira Gershwin, playwright Maxwell Anderson, and comic poet Ogden Nash. Some of Nash's best verses are in his lyrics for Weill.
Speak low, darling, speak low. Love is a spark lost in the dark. Too soon, I fear, wherever I go, that tomorrow is near, tomorrow is here, and always too soon. Time is so old and love so brief. Love is pure gold and time a thief. We're late.
But few of these numbers match Weill's breakthrough works of the late 20s. Lenya's world weariness actually helps reduce some of the saccharine content. It's the Berlin album, though, that's especially high on my list of Desert Island records. My original copy wore out long ago. So now both these albums are available in a format that doesn't wear out, and that considerably improves the original engineering. But in order to fit both LPs onto one CD, four of the best German songs were left out. Numbers like the eerily graphic Ballad of the Drowned Girl, a song about German revolutionary Rosa Luxemburg from Brecht's rarely performed Berlin Requiem, and the hilariously harrowing Sailor's Tango from Happy End, in which a doomsday storm drowns the cigar-smoking, whiskey-guzzling sailors in a lovely sea of blue, so blue.
Ja, das Meer Gang. Und wenn die Chance aus ist, dann fängt's von vorne an. Ja, das Meer ist blau, so blau, und das geht ja auch noch lang. Ja, das Meer ist blau, so blau. Ja, das Meer ist blau, so blau. Ja, das Meer ist blau, so blau. Das Meer ist blau.
But there's a more insidious omission. With no acknowledgement, the central sections of Surabaya Johnny and the Bilbao song have been edited out. Fully a third of each song is missing. The only trace of them is in the accompanying booklet that prints all the words. Besides being immoral, these abridgments butcher Vile's innovative structures. They leave out some of Lenya's most spine-tingling moments, or else make others seem melodramatic because they haven't been properly prepared for. The original LPs are hard to find, but at least they're officially still available, and they remain more indispensable than ever.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix.
Surabaya Johnny, warum bist du so roh? Surabaya Johnny, mein Gott, und ich liebe dich so. Surabaya Johnny, warum bin ich nicht froh? Du hast kein Herz, Johnny, und ich liebe.
This is Fresh Air. This time last summer, you couldn't pass a radio without hearing the song La Bamba from the hit film about Ritchie Valens. Valens was played by an unknown actor from Arlington, Texas, named Lou Diamond Phillips. Phillips played a Hispanic high school student in his next film, Stand and Deliver. Now he's hoping for another summer hit with his new film, Young Guns, a Western, directed by Christopher Kane and featuring box office stars Charlie Sheen, Kiefer Sutherland, and Emilio Estevez. Phillips says he's amazed that he's been accepted into this circle of young actors, given that it's only been a year since his first feature film role, one that he's still proud of and willing to talk about.
Overall, I was absolutely thrilled, because I think enough time and distance has gone by that I look at the screen and I don't see myself, I see Ritchie. And I think most importantly, the most important feedback I got from the entire film was the fact that the family, Ritchie's mom, Ritchie's sisters, his brother, they all looked up at the screen and said, "That's Ritchie."
The part that you're playing now in Young Guns, which is about to be released, has been described as a knife-throwing, peyote-ingesting, spiritual guide, Chavez.
Yeah, the kind of guy you'd want to take home to mom.
A killer, yes. I love taking killers home, ones that can throw large knives.
Absolutely. I'm pretty much a human Cuisinart in this movie. You know, it's really an incredible role. It is an incredible role that took me into places that I had not been before.
Oh, really? Inside yourself, right?
Yeah, a lot of that. I mean, you know, it's always strange for an actor to sit around and talk about how he approaches a role. But this was a very interesting role to get inside, not to mention the fact that it was a lot of fun. I mean, you know, this is a Western. This is a shoot 'em up. And they're not making those that much these days, so it was an absolute fantasy trip.
Yeah, young boys fantasy, cowboy and Indians, and you get to play the Indian, right?
That's right, and still be a good guy. So,
are you a good guy?
Yes, I mean, you know, I'm one of the heroes, believe it or not. I mean, it's one of those gray area heroes like, you know, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, all of us. Emilio Estevez plays Billy the Kid. So how much of a hero can he be? I mean, we're, you know, anti-heroes to a large extent.
Apparently there's a peyote ritual scene that you get into. There's this terrible picture of you in magazines. You're wearing this sort of skeleton makeup and holding a Bowie knife.
Yeah, a very big knife.
Now, how much research did you do for that particular scene?
Quite a bit of research. The makeup itself, actually, that the skull was my idea. But in doing the research, finding out how the peyote religion and the peyote culture sort of traveled northward into New Mexico through Texas and all of that, and how the Navajos were very firmly entrenched in those beliefs, gave me a lot of insight into the character, into his spirituality. And reading about the rituals, I found out that many times the Navajos would disguise themselves as the spirits because they truly believed they were entering the spirit world. So not to get recognized and not to be harmed by the spirits, they would try to look like spirits, which was basically why I developed the skull makeup.
Is it true that Christopher Kane hired a psychic?
What?
I heard that Christopher Kane hired a psychic to kind of get into the real feelings of Billy the Kid. Is this a total falsehood? something they didn't tell you, right?
Something I sure didn't know about. Oh. Maybe, you know, I think it was Ronald Reagan's psychic. You know, he had done all those westerns before, and we tried to contact the spirit of the B-movie hero. Well, guys, what you have to do here is call in the cavalry. You know, I don't know. No, that as far as I know, that's a total falsehood.
Westerns, to me, that bring to mind horses and you have to throw all these knives. Did you do your own stunts in this?
Yes. As a matter of fact, in the shooting process, I did every stunt but one. But the one stunt that I didn't do is not in the film, so I can honestly say I did every stunt that you see in the movie.
What are the good ones that we see?
At one point, we ambush some of the bad guys, and not to give away too much of the plot, I won't say who it is, but I come bursting around the corner on a horse with a knife in my teeth. I lean off the horse, hanging on one side of the horse, and throw the knife over the saddle and hit someone in the neck.
How did you learn to throw these knives?
By throwing knives, basically.
There's a lot riding on this film. I mean, people are saying...
So to speak.
Yeah, so to speak, right.
Like six young buns.
Yeah, six young buns, right. Yeah. Yes, and we all love it. And but the whole revival of the Western as a genre and that sort of thing, I mean, when the critics take this sort of film apart, that's the kind of things that they have to say. There's no pressure on you while you're making the movie from the industry, is there?
No, but you realize you're being watched. I have a feeling we're very much open for pot shots on this film. You know, it's a bunch of young guys out playing cowboys and Indians, and I feel that that may lend itself to some criticism. But if the audience goes to see it, I think that is going to be what determines if the Western will, ride back out of the sunset.
Do you have problems in dealing with the industry itself in terms of the kinds of roles that you get offered? Do you find there are people who want to stereotype you as, you were the resident in-house gang type, right, in your theater company in Texas, that sort of thing. I mean, your background is so... Well, it's Filipino, Hawaiian, Chinese, Hispanic, Scotch-Irish, Cherokee, Indian, all of this thing. Being typecast as, as an ethnic.
No. And it's because I think the public at large does not see what I'm being offered until it comes out onto the screen. They don't see the things I turn down, or they don't see the things that I take. I will not turn down ethnic roles just because they're ethnic. If they're good roles, I'll take them. In what I consider to be good movies. You know, if there's some producer out there sitting there going, well, we got a white boy role here, let's offer it to Lou, I'm sure he'll jump at the chance. That's not necessarily true. I have done non-ethnic roles in movies where the ethnicity does not matter. Two of them, one called Dakota and another one that I'm very excited about, a comedy called Waiting for Salazar, which will come out, I believe, this Christmas. My point is that I'm being offered all kinds of roles. Ethnic, non-ethnic, younger, older, that sort of thing. I mean, I'm in the wonderful position of having a choice. There's a variety of things out there to do. And no longer, I think, because I have proven, I think, a certain amount of versatility, even within the same, category. Angel and Stand and Deliver and Richie and La Bamba are both Hispanic, but they're miles and miles apart. And as long as I can be challenged as an actor and I think bring something new to the screen, new and different as far as I'm concerned, then I'm very happy.
You're working with Kiefer Sutherland on
a
new film. Kiefer is one of your co-stars in Young Guns.
Yes, Kiefer's a wonderful actor. And, that's just a testament to the fact that we all got together very, very well on Guns. There was never any problems with ego or, you know, prima donnaism. I mean, it was all a very supportive, together group, and I'd work with any of them again, given the opportunity. Well, I got the opportunity right away, and Kiefer and I will be making another film this fall.
Tell us the story about you and Kiefer Sutherland on the plane.
It's like I said, we tend to give each other a hard time sometimes. I was giving him a hard time about his hair in Lost Boys, you know. It's like, and the fact that I'm sure he uses peroxide, but he actually doesn't. But we were going to Los Angeles. I mean, it was literally an overnight trip. We were flying out on a Learjet from Santa Fe to Los Angeles because they were premiering the trailer, which is, you know, the preview of upcoming events, to all of the foreign distributors. As a result, and I think because we were there, everyone got very excited, and the whole world was sold out before the movie was even finished, which was relatively amazing. But at any rate, we are on this Learjet. We're going to Los Angeles. It's my first time on a small plane like this. And we start going down into Los Angeles, and those things are so small that when the wind blows, forget it, you know. It's bouncing around and everything, and I'm holding on to the armrests. And Kiefer has this leer that's right out of Lost Boys, and he turns to me in this gravelly voice, and he goes, la, 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 bamba. You know, and, it's not funny. That's not funny, man. It's not funny. You know?
It is funny.
Yeah, I know. I laughed about it once we got on the ground, and I was able to go, hey, that was clever, Kiefer. Yeah, right, pal.
Well, to paraphrase a line from La Bamba, what, movie stars don't fall out of the sky?
That's right. That's it, yeah. The sky belongs to the stars, Richie. Woo-doo-boo!
Lou Diamond Phillips, thanks a lot for taking the time to talk to us today.
Oh, thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Lou Diamond Phillips can be seen in the new film Young Guns, opening August 12th.
Pretty baby, I love you so well.
This is Fresh Air. We'll go down to Washington now to find out what's coming up on All Things Considered. And with me is Robert Siegel, who hosts the show. Hello, Robert.
Hello, Leanne.
So what do you have for us today?
Well, we're following some events in Washington, among them the president's veto of the defense bill, the impeachment of U.S. District Court Judge Alcy Hastings, and also some leaks about the Navy's study, its investigation of the Vincennes incident, the shooting down of the Iranian Airbus. Also, we have an obituary today on of the short story writer and poet Raymond Carver, who died 2 days ago, and remembrance and appreciation of him from a couple of very close friends and writers who knew him quite well.
Thank you very much, Robert. That's all coming up on All Things Considered. Summer is the season when most of us try to enjoy nature. But you have to be wary of things like poison ivy and ticks, too much sun, and those little bugs with pincers known as earwigs. However, urban legends expert Jan Harald Brunvand says stories you may have heard about earwigs attacking humans are largely unfounded.
The proverbial expression to put a bug in your ear, meaning to implant an idea in your mind, is said to originate from the belief that earwigs creep into people's ears. Although earwigs seldom creep into people's ears, their popular name plus an urban legend perpetuate that fear. In the usual story, a woman is lying on a beach when a little earwig slips into her ear and crawls straight ahead as far as possible. The Oxford English Dictionary, the OED, that Bible of every word watcher, traces the word earwig, meaning ear insect, back to Old English and Middle English prototypes that looks sort of like the modern name as it might be spelled by someone with an insect buzzing in his ear, Earwigon, Eorwiga, and so forth. The OED dates the name of the insect, as well as, quote, the notion that it penetrates into the head through the ear, to at least the year 1000. Sometimes I have a notion to ask people who still believe in ear-entering earwigs if they have ever really experienced anything like this, or known anyone who has, or even known anyone who knew anyone else who has. The next part of the earwig story is the hardest to swallow. Listen to this. Supposedly, a doctor examines the poor young woman with the earwig lodged in her ear and says, he's too far in to grab. We'll just have to let him work his way through and come out the other side. Her doctor makes one big error in this diagnosis by saying him, for when the insect does emerge from the other ear, he's a she. Then the doc explains grimly, I'm afraid this female earwig may have laid eggs in your head, and if so, they'll hatch and eventually eat out your brain. The other assumption behind this wild story is that medical students take entomology courses in college just so they will be able to distinguish male from female earwigs. To return to the metaphorical bug in your ear, the OED also records the verb to earwig going back to 1837, meaning to pester, influence, or bias a person by insinuating yourself like an earwig into his confidence. Which brings me to a recent manifestation of the legend in popular culture. In Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, a big film hit a few years back, the villainous Khan, you remember this, insinuates space creatures into the ears of two Starship Enterprise officers in order to make them subservient to his commands. In the summer of 1982, when this Star Trek flick was the rage, a newspaper editor in Boise, Idaho, remembered an 11-year-old local news item about an earwig. The editor revived the story from the paper's back file and put a replay of it on the AP wire as a sort of footnote to the Star Trek film. It's the one case I found of an earwig actually entering someone's ear. That someone was Janet Ward of Boise, who back in 1971, when the Boise area had been infested with earwigs, consulted her doctor about an intense earache. Using forceps, the doctor extracted what the news story reports as an earwig from her ear. Okay, so an earwig can enter an ear. I'll admit that much. But a place has to be pretty darn earwiggy, in fact, positively smothering in earwigginess, to support such a thing happening. I found those wonderful words, earwiggy and earwigginess, listed in the OED, but not used since the 1870s. Let me put this bug in your ear. How about introducing both words back into current usage? But don't believe the story about female earwigs laying eggs in someone's head. That's just another urban legend.
Jan Harald Brunvand is professor of English and folklore at the University of Utah. His book, The Mexican Pet, has just been published in paperback by W.W. Norton. Here's what's coming up on tomorrow's show. On the next Fresh Air, I speak with writer Bobby Ann Mason. Mason's fiction includes Shiloh and Other Stories and the novel In Country, which is now being made into a movie. Her new novel, Spence Plus Lila, is the story of a rural Kentucky couple coming to terms with their own mortality. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Brian Wilson, the solo album by the former member of the Beach Boys. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Die Hard, the action thriller starring TV's Bruce Willis. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Leanne Hansen. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.